1st of August 1933. A nice way of starting a month. We all overslept this morning and even Mum didn't wake till just before 8. I had to go without breakfast and, to cap it all, was bad on the train, though not actually sick. Dad wasn't so badly off, as he hadn't to get in until 9. I didn't arrive at the office until 9:15. Mucked about with the wireless again tonight. Changed the earth from outside to the water main and changed the grid bias about a bit. It still gurgles, though. 2nd of August 1933. Wireless groggy again this evening, so I change over the accumulators thinking that that might be the cause. But after a while, the unspillable accumulator gave out altogether. I certainly had no idea that it was down to that level, so I put it on charge tonight. Had a good play called Quinny by H.A. Vackel with Cyril Maude in the title role. Phil and Bill are coming here, Plaistow, for a week tomorrow. Mum is going to meet them at Stratford. Dunn is up at the same time and is staying with Grandma at Kenton. 3rd of August 1933. Apart from the brief relapse on Monday, it has been gradually getting hotter and hotter till today it is very sultry indeed. Even I, who work in an exceedingly cool office, too cool during the winter, have felt the heat all this afternoon. I'll wager it will be like an oven in the train tonight, crowded or not. I've had to spend a lot on postage this week. 2 and 6 odd on the application for the final set of volumes of the Daily Herald Dickens presentation set. A letter to Auntie Lil about the boys, and another to Odham's Press about that writing set I applied for before I went away. It appears that the last was delivered 3 times, according to a note from the local post office, and that after 3 days from the 19th of July, it would be treated as undeliverable, so I have applied direct to the senders. The boys arrived all right and managed to amuse themselves most of the evening. 4th of August 1933. It's blisteringly hot again today, even hotter than yesterday, though the shade temperature is only 84 degrees. I believe one feels the heat more because of the clamminess of the air. Last week the temperature was much higher, but it didn't seem half so hot. I found, when I reached home tonight, that my fountain pen and pencil had arrived, so they'd been quick in answering my letter. Owing to the hardness of the nib, I suppose, the writing seems rather faint, but one can write more clearly than with the one I borrowed from Dad whilst I was away. That pen had a medium nib. I'm pleased with its performance and hope the pencil will have the same good results. The boys had made good use of my Meccano and had occupied themselves with it most of the day. 5th of August 1933. Dad's birthday today. And I'm sorry to say I forgot to wish him many happy returns this morning before I came away. This afternoon I'm to take the boys to Woolwich and let them see the docks and the ferry. Bill's getting very excited about it and I hope he won't be disappointed. High tide, I find, is just after 2 o'clock. And as we shan't get there till after 3, perhaps we shall miss any boats that may happen to be going in or out of the King George V dock. Anyhow, there will be plenty of other ships to interest them. I hope the Mammoth floating crane is in the Albert dock too, but I hear it has been lately down to Tilbury to assist in loading the Royal Scot LMS train for America, and they may have kept the crane moored there. We set off soon after 3 and took a bus to the White Horse and went thence by tram to the Royal Albert docks. We went over the swing bridge, having a good look at the shipping on the way, and when we reached the King George V dock, found the pleasure steamer that takes people round the docks for 3 and 6 a time was in the entrance lock, waiting to be raised to the level of the dock before entering. We had a good view when the bascule bridge was raised, and as we were on the wharf, a big Greek vessel came through from the dock. We stood watching this till it safely got out. It was nowhere near loaded, there being about 6 feet of hull showing below the waterline. Thence we walked to the ferry and crossed the river and took a tram as far as the foot of Bostall Hill. We climbed up to Bostall Woods and mucked about there for a while and then returned by tram to the ferry and came by bus to the town hall and so home, reaching it just after 7. 7th of August 1933. Bank holiday. We boys had another all-day ticket each and set out at 10:15 this morning, determined to have 12 hours of it. We took a number 5 tram to Wanstead Flats and stayed to gone 11 o'clock at the fair. Then we got a tram to Leighton and caught another to Chingford Mount, where we had lunch at 12:15 p.m. We left Chingford at 1:15 and caught a tram via Leighton to Clapton Station and changed for Amherst Park, where we had to get off and walk to Finsbury Park, not far, as the 1 shilling all-day ticket didn't apply to that part. From Finsbury Park, we caught a train to King's Cross and, of course, visited the station. After about an hour, we took a bus to Baker Street, as it was too hot to walk, and another thence to Paddington Station, which we reached soon after 4 o'clock. We saw the Cornish Riviera and Cheltenham Flyer come in, the former 3 minutes late and the latter 10 minutes late, and sat down by the signal box at the end of number one platform and had our tea. We left there soon after six and crossed over Bishop's Road Bridge to the Harrow Road, whence we caught a tram to Scrubs Lane, paying a penny each, as by the side of Kensal Green Cemetery, the all-day tickets do not apply. From Scrubs Lane, we got a tram via Putney, Wandsworth and Earlsfield to Tooting Broadway, and caught another to Kennington Church, where we changed for Catford via Dulwich. This carried us to Lewisham Clock Tower, and we caught another to Woolwich via Eltham. We reached Eltham at 9 o'clock, and Bedford Square half an hour later. As there were so many people getting on the trams there, we walked to the ferry, and it was quite dark before we reached the other side of the river. We walked past the docks to the trams, and came home via the East Ham Town Hall. We arrived just after 10:30. 10th of August, 1933. After much correspondence on the subject, Phil and Bill have received a letter saying that they may continue their stay until Monday, else they were to go back today. 11th of August, 1933. Very cool again today, a great contrast to the weather we have been having, and this afternoon the rain drizzled down for a couple of hours, the first steady rain for the past month or so. This evening I had a turn at the piano, and we had a bit of a sing-song. 12th of August, 1933. This afternoon, I'm meeting the boys at Aldgate, and we're going to the South Kensington Museums. They're bringing some lunch with them, so we shall probably have it in the Natural History Museum grounds. It is a long time since I went to the science. I don't believe I've been to any of the others since Phil was staying with us in September 1931. Bill's never been, so far as I'm aware. I met them at Aldgate, and we had lunch at Woolworth's cafeteria, and then took a bus to Charing Cross. Here I asked them if they would like to go over the Houses of Parliament, and though Phil was in favour, Bill was uncertain. So we walked down Whitehall, but when we found it was nearly 3 o'clock, we hopped on a bus instead, and changing at Victoria Station, we reached the museums about 3:15. We went into the cinema at the Victoria and Albert Museum, Indian section, but only saw half a film before it was all over. Then we went to the science and made a cursory exploration of that museum, and were about halfway through when the bell rang for closing time. So we came out and walked across Kensington Gardens and Hyde Park to Marble Arch and caught a bus home. There are several new things in the science since I last went. They've a full-size pterodactyl plane, Amy Johnson's original plane, Jason, the one she went to Australia in 1930, several new gears in the turbine section, a lot more change gears in the motor car section, including an epicycle, self-changing gearbox, and a host of others. Anyway, the boys didn't seem to get tired of it, and the limited time we had there passed all too quickly. 13th of August, 1933. We all went by train to Upminster today and walked to the Common, where we had lunch. Then I took the boys over the common and played ball and generally romped about with them while the others tried to get asleep. Then Bill, Phil and I went down Nag's Head Lane to Hillman's Aerodrome and watched one or two planes take off and land. I would have taken them up, but Mum said not. Then we returned via the road past the sanatorium and had something to eat. And after another game with the ball, we walked back to the station and were just in time to catch a train back. We caught the South Enders all right at Barking and were very glad we already had seats. 14th of August, 1933. The boys go back today. They tried to get a further extension till Wednesday, but it couldn't be arranged. So they're going to catch the bus at Stratford this morning about 10:30. I expect it will seem quiet tonight without them. They've been very good, both of them, and I for one shouldn't have been annoyed if they could have stayed the fortnight. 15th of August, 1933. I was late getting off to work this morning, so that the postman came before I left home. He brought a missive, postmarked from Hammersmith, and it contains a letter purporting to come from the National Union of News Vendors, enclosing tickets and a sweepstake on the St. Ledger. Or rather, I should say, a book of 25 tickets, meaning me to sell the tickets and return the cash and counterfoils. But before I commit myself, I'm going to find out if it is genuine. I asked a friend's advice, and he told me of an uncle of his who'd sold certain tickets that he'd received through the post in a similar manner and had read in John Bull that the thing was a fraud and had to return the purchase money out of his own pocket. These people say that the results will be published in the Daily Herald and the Daily Express, and perhaps it would be best to write to the editor of the Daily Herald to see if the affair is genuine. Such a change in the weather. Cold and mostly showers. Miss the boys not being here. Seems dull and quiet, but I shall soon get over that. 19th of August, 1933. As Uncle Sid was over for today, Mum proposed that we should do that walk between Pilgrim's Hatch and Blackmoor that I have so often wanted them to go. So we took a bus to the Princess Alice and a Hillman's coach thence to Brentwood and a small country bus to Pilgrim's Hatch, where we arrived about midday. We then walked up the road, which is my usual route on the bike, till we came to Doddinghurst about 1 o'clock. And as Dad and Uncle were feeling thirsty, we took a short cut across a footpath to Blackmoor to get to the pub before it closed. Doddinghurst, by the way, is the first place I've noticed where there is a church and no pub. It's generally the other way about. Having refreshed ourselves, we strolled past the green and down the road towards Jericho Priory, as I intended us to have lunch by the ford. But they were tired, and so we had our dinner in a field by the side of the road. After a good nap, we took another footpath, which brought us out to Blackmoor Church, and Mum, Dad and Uncle had a pot of tea at the Leather Bottle, while I had a glass of milk. We finished this about 5 o'clock, and then had to wait till 25 minutes past for a bus to take us into Ongar. We reached that town at 5:45 and caught a Green Line coach, which left at 6 o'clock for Epping. Here we had not to wait long before a bus came along, which took us via Loughton and Woodford to the George, Wanstead, where we caught another bus home. Altogether, we had travelled some 44 miles at a total cost of 13 shillings, or 3 shillings and threepence each, which shows how much I save by going by bike. 21st of August 1933. We had a good variety show on the wireless tonight, relayed from the radio exhibition at Olympia. The performers included Clapham and Dwyer, Flotsam and Jetsam, Tommy Handley and Julian Rose. The audience gave them a great reception. I think many people have been surprised at the popularity of the BBC Dance Orchestra under Henry Hall, which has made its first public appearances at this show. 22nd of August 1933. It is more than 4.5 years since I last had my spectacles changed. The reason for the delay is principally because I have been hoping to recover some of the expense through the National Health Insurance. Having put it off long enough, though my 5 years were up last April, I called on Mr. Lyons in Green Street, where I obtained the present spectacles in December 1928, and had a consultation as I was going home tonight. He reports that my eyes have greatly improved, which, I take it, means that they are tending towards normal again. He tells me that the lenses will cost a good deal, as, apart from my having short sight, I suffer from astigmatism, which apparently necessitates the use of special lenses for its correction. I had anticipated this to some extent, as the existing spectacles had cost about 30 shillings. I asked if he could fix the new lenses in the existing frame, and he says that if I will go tomorrow night, he will have a temporary frame fitted up for me while he fixes up the existing frame. 23rd of August 1933. Somewhere in the remote past, one of Grandma's uncles, name unknown to me, is supposed to have been coming home from some races and, having had a good day, came by train on the Great Western. To this train, an accident happened, burst boiler or something similar, and the flywheel hit this yokel sufficiently hard to kill him. He was supposed to be the first man killed on the Great Western Railway. Now, I'm reading Volume 1 of the official history of this railway, and the account of the first accident is roughly this. Brunel, the engineer of the line, and several other persons were waiting at a wayside station, the name of which I forget at the moment, early one morning, when a luggage train was seen approaching at excessive speed. They called to the engine driver to stop, but he took no notice. Instead, the train rushed on into an engine shed, where it did a lot of damage and killed the driver, and in the first coach, the guard and four passengers, who were the only persons on the train. The engine driver was subsequently found to have been asleep when he was driving. Now, this happens to be the only accident fatal to a passenger on that line up to the year 1854. This accident occurred in 1840. I haven't drawn any conclusions, but the following facts may help. The flywheel part seems about the oddest. One pictures one of Trevithick's early locos, or a thing resembling a traction engine. At the same time, the accident occurred 16 years before Grandma was born, which is likely anyhow, and may account for the facts of the case becoming embroidered a little. Again, the fact that the victim was returning after a good day may place the accident after midnight, and if in the summer, a little before dawn. I'll bring the book here and copy it out tomorrow. 25th of August 1933. On my way home tonight, I called at the optician's and he took the old lenses out of my frames and fitted up the new ones. I don't know, but I don't think they're right, as although things near aren't so bad, they get misty as they recede. I couldn't read the plate of a motor car 30 yards distant before, and I'm certain I cannot 10 yards distant now. Even while I write this, the words appear fuzzy. I shall call in on the way home tomorrow afternoon, I think, and see if something cannot be done about it. After all, 10 shillings per lens is a lot of money. 26th of August 1933. I went to the Premier Cinema this afternoon to see The Crime of the Century, a very good film which had an innovation in the shape of a minute's interval being provided in the middle for the public to consider and guess who the perpetrator of the crime might be. I guessed wrong. The other films were piffle. 29th of August 1933. I went to the optician's on Saturday about these new lenses, and he told me to come again on Monday, as probably I hadn't had time to get used to them. I didn't go last night, but I did tonight, and he's going to change them back to the old ones while he gets a pair of slightly stronger power than the new ones. He seemed reluctant to do this, as he explains that with myopia, the eye is subject to grow to such a size by continual straining that the retina, unable to stand up to it, bursts and leaves the sufferer almost blind. I certainly had no idea that it was so dangerous as that, though he says I should be twice as short-sighted as I am now before that happened. He says that, for this reason, it is extremely dangerous to provide lenses of too strong a correcting power. 30th of August 1933. During my spare time at work just lately, I have been occupied in studying the principles of interlocking, as I read in that book on mechanical signalling engineering. It is a most intriguing subject, and having worked out one or two simple examples, I am at present engaged on a complicated junction, though many curse words have been used on it already. I called on Mr. Lyons, the optician, on my way home, and he fixed me up with the old right lens and the new left. I can see much better now. I am to call in on Friday night to be set up finally, I hope.